wonderful to see the Peacock Theatre practically full. I'm sure the rest of the evening will take a moment. Welcome to the seventh lecture in our Miliband series on globalisation and global economic governance. The series started, for those you might recall, in January with Joe Stiglitz, and it includes so far our own Robert Wade, John Ruggie, Bob Cohane, and others. And I'm delighted this evening, quite thrilled in fact, to welcome Naomi Klein. Naomi, in fact, will be giving two lectures, the second one being Economic Terror and Deep Democracy, next Tuesday, the 22nd of October. For those of you who don't know much about Naomi's background, I'll just speak just for a few moments about it. She was born in Montreal and is an award-winning journalist and author of the international bestseller, needless to say, No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies. It's been translated into over 25 languages. The New York Times referred to it as a movement Bible. The Guardian newspaper shortlisted No Logo for the first book award in 2000. In April 2001, No Logo won the Canadian National Business Book Award, and in August 2001, it was awarded a major prize in France. The Guardian said of No Logo, the descapital of the growing anti-corporate movement. The Financial Times said, a manifesto and call to arms that sometimes reads like an Orwellian nightmare. And ID magazine, I like this one particularly, said, don't miss this visionary book, perfectly pitched for our suspect over corporate times. Klein, a young, funky heiress to Chomsky, I couldn't say that by me, but I can quote it, has written valiantly about resistance to the multinational mindset. Naomi Klein's articles have appeared in numerous publications, including The Nation, The Guardian, Newsweek, and many others. And she writes an internationally syndicated column for the Globe and Mail in Canada and The Guardian in Britain. For the past 6 years, Naomi has traveled throughout North America, Asia, Latin America, and Europe, tracking the rise of anti-corporate activism. And she's a frequent media commentator, recently named as one of Miss Magazine's Women of the Year, and has lectured at such, well, how can we say it, dubious universities as Harvard, Yale, and New York University. But at last, she's come to the really great citadel of learning, the London School of Economics. Naomi's just published a new book called Fences and Windows, which was available outside, and is working on a very sustained documentary on Argentina and participatory democracy. This evening, Naomi will speak for about an hour, and then there'll be time for questions, nota bene, questions, not statements, so short questions, please, which I will take in clusters of about five to give you all a chance to raise points if you can in the time available, which of course isn't going to be very much. The lecture this evening is called Escape from the Global Fortress, the State of the Globalization Debate. And I will speak for an hour, or questions for half an hour, and I hope very much you enjoy the evening. So please join me to welcome Naomi.
Into a spillover room a little ways away. I will try to speak very loudly so that you can hear me. I owe a very special debt of gratitude to David Hell and to Anthony Giddens and to the Miliband Fellowship Program for bringing me here to the LSC. I've been here for a couple of weeks and it's already been a very stimulating and engaging experience. But I have to admit that when I first got here, I felt like that David had somehow smuggled me in here through the back door as kind of an undercover agent. And as you can imagine, my ideas about economics tend not to coincide with the standard issue, not to say there would ever be standard issue course material at the LSC, but let's just say that there was. My ideas about economics would not necessarily fit within those parameters. And I think that might be because I'm not a theorist. As David said, I'm a journalist, and I spend my time looking at how free market theory plays out in people's lives. So I find myself much less interested in elegant systems of trickle-down and invisible hands than in the messy reality of thirsty people and greased palms. And one of the things that I think we all know right now, all of us who are interested in the field of global economics, is that there is something of a crisis of legitimacy going on. That's why there are all these books being published with titles like In Defense of the Global Economy. Let's face it, post-Enron, post-Argentina, things aren't looking so good for status quo economics. But I think that if the field of economics is to regain its legitimacy, then the economists of tomorrow, and I think there probably are quite a few of them in this room here tonight, are going to have to let go of what I believe is an extraordinarily dangerous fantasy, that there is an ideal world out there where markets work the way they're supposed to work. Now, you know the perfect world that I'm talking about because you read about it in your textbook and they teach it to you in class. This is a kind of fantasy utopia, not Disneyland, but Adam Smith land. This is a fantastic place where all the politicians are much more interested in liberating markets because it's the right thing to do, and they would never use privatizations to line their own pockets. Where corporate executives are more interested in fostering efficiency and competition and not in building powerful monopolies. Where soaring growth always lifts the poorest out of poverty instead of deepening class divides. This is a world where rich and poor countries all live by the same trade rules, not a world where rich countries force poor countries to live at the mercy of a volatile global market while they themselves hide behind subsidies and protection. This fantasy world, this Adam Smith land, is a world where the cool rule of law matters much more than the crass rule of power and wealth. A world where governments and corporations do what they say instead of what they can actually get away with. In Adam Smith land, unlike, say, in China, free markets create free people, as George Bush says. Now, you know, it's usually left-wing activists and campaigners, people like me, who are dismissed as dreamers and idealists, while economists are cast as hard-nosed pragmatists, realists. But I actually think that we might have it backwards, and that it's neoliberal economists who are the true idealists, the starry-eyed dreamers, their eyes always fixed heavenwards on this utopian ideal rather than on the ground. Because even after a decade of unprecedented growth and wealth creation that has left us more divided, more unequal, they still believe that the market messiah will someday arrive. Now you might ask, what is wrong with studying ideals? What's wrong with utopia? What's wrong with having something to strive for? I think that what's wrong and what's truly dangerous about it is that it blinds us to the reality of this world, to the people who, as we speak, are being sacrificed on the altar of theory, who are dying of thirst as they wait for the trickle down, who are not being helped up by invisible hands, but are being punched out by very real invisible fists as they struggle for a better life. There's no point in studying how markets work without, I'm afraid, studying how power works, how it has an unfortunate tendency to centralize, a terrible tendency to be abused, to resort to brute force when its interests are threatened. This unwillingness to look at how theory plays out in practice is the great sin of all true believers, of people who believe so deeply in these elegant, beautiful systems laid out in books and Bibles, religious, economic, or political, that they can no longer see real people, the fallibility of the people who run these systems, and the humanity of the people who are subject to their strict rules. And you can always tell a true believer, because whenever life interferes with the plan, with the system, the true believers will always tell you that the problem is not with the system, It's with the way the system was enforced. It wasn't enforced strictly enough. So religious fundamentalists will say, you know, somewhere a woman is showing her ankle, and that's the problem. And we have to strive for a more literal, more fixed implementation of the text of the word. And if redemption doesn't come, it is, of course, because of the heathens, because of the failure to interpret the rules correctly. Now, we don't know exactly what happened in Bali this weekend, but if the obvious explanation turns out to be true, then this same logic will have, yet again, been at the root of a despicable act, a fundamentalist attack on a Western playground. Now, lest you think I only use this label of fundamentalism or true believer against people I disagree with, I hasten to tell you that I think that there are plenty of fundamentalists on the left. People who look at the failures, for instance, of state socialism in the former Soviet Union, for instance, and say, of course, that the problem was not the theory, but that the theory wasn't enforced strictly enough. And there are plenty of economic fundamentalists out there. People who, and I've heard this a lot when I was in Argentina, who look at the tragedy of the failure of the economic, the neoliberal economic experiment in Argentina, and we have to remember that Argentina was the model student of the IMF for much of the past decade. They look at the mess this country now finds itself in, and they dare to say that the problem was not the deregulation and privatization, but it was that they didn't privatize enough things. There are still a few things that have yet to be privatized. And I have to tell you, in Argentina, even the street signs have been sold in Buenos Aires. The street signs are brought to you by MasterCard. So when you push them, you know, what is left to privatize in Argentina? They say the ports. So of course, it's not the practice. It's not the theory. It's the practice. They need to, and where this becomes dangerous is because then we're told that Argentina needs to swallow more bitter medicine in a country where more than half the population is already living in deep and desperate poverty. They need more shock therapy, we're told. So it's dangerous to believe so deeply in systems that it blinds you to people, that it hardens your heart to suffering, and that it tells you that causing more suffering will bring some kind of redemption in the future, in this life or next, in this generation or next. That, I believe, in a nutshell, this deferred, this delayed satisfaction, this wait for the Messiah, this is fundamentalist logic at work. That's how you spot it. And I believe that it's the great challenge of the new century to fight against this logic in all of its forms. Religious, political, and economic. To build a world that has room for people to be protagonists in their own destinies, not bit characters in a script that's already been written. Now, in my next lecture, as David said, on October 22nd, I'm going to be describing in some depth the ways that different people and movements around the world are attempting to rise to this challenge, to develop a theory of democracy that is non-fundamentalist by its very nature, that is based on participatory democracy and human need. And I'm going to be focusing in particular on what's going on in Argentina, not on the crisis, but on the alternatives that are emerging there. Today what I'm going to be doing is providing a kind of an overview of the state of the globalization debate and do some of what I've been talking about, measuring theory against practice. Now, one of the people who's been most helpful to me here at the LSC is a young woman named Aisha Kaya. I hope she doesn't mind me singling her out. She's a graduate student who's working with David Heldam in the Novam program. And on my first night here at the LSC, Aisha told me that she was worried about talking to me about globalization. And I asked her why, and she said, because I have definitional issues. And I have to admit, I found that quite charming that she had definitional issues, because I visit a lot of universities in North America, and the students there have lots of issues. Or if my cousin's in LA, they just call them shoes. She says, we have shoes about that. But she's usually referring to self-esteem issues, motivational issues. But here at the LSE, you have you have definitional issues. I'm not sure if you can get treatment for that or whether it's covered. But I realize that that we all have definitional issues about globalization. I certainly have definitional issues about globalization. And they come up all the time. So I'm going to try to sort them out. We'll have some definitional issues there here tonight. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Washington, D.C. During a meeting of the World Bank and the IMF. And I debated on public television one of the editors of The Economist, their Washington bureau chief. And the interviewer started the debate by asking us to define globalization. And this Economist editor replied, in a word, freedom. Free trade, free people, free societies, building bridges across the world. And I just came back from Frankfurt from the book fair, and I had another opportunity to deal with my globalization issues, I mean, my definitional issues. I took part in a debate with Daniel Cohn-Bendit, the former 68 radical who's now a member of the European Parliament for the Greens. And he defined globalization and European integration also in terms of freedom and bridges. And he talked passionately about fences coming down between countries, Germany and France in particular, that would have been unthinkable even a decade ago. And this idea of globalization, this vision of bridges and barriers coming down is a wonderful one, it's a beautiful one. And you can never really be against freedom and bridges, that's like being against sunshine and puppies or something. But I want to show you some slides to try to tell you what I'm talking about when I talk about corporate globalization. It doesn't have a lot to do with bridges. It has more to do with fences. And so we're going to look at some images. Now that first slide there, I guess this is the quintessential image of the promise of globalization, of walls coming down, of fences coming down. That's 13 years ago. And here are the snapshots that I'm talking about of what I see when I try to measure the theory of globalization against the practice. Oh, it's working like a charm. It's not always the case. Okay. Bye, guys. Here
they come.
Okay. Alright. This is a maquiladora factory, an export processing zone in Nicaragua. And this is a scene that I've seen played out over and over again at export processing factories for export, where you see young women who are younger than you guys lining up to get jobs, to come into these gated zones, which are protected by armed guards. And there's a couple of reasons for having, and here you see, you can't even have vendors inside the export processing zone, so they make the food on the outside and then they pass it on through the barbed wire here. Part of the reason why they have these fences is because the goods that are produced in export processing zones can't leave the fenced-in area and be sold in the domestic market because there are all these subsidies and reduced tariffs and tax breaks that the companies that are located there have gotten in order to, as an incentive. So it wouldn't be fair for the products that they produce, whether it's clothing or toys or electronics, to be sold domestically and competing against domestically produced products. But there's another reason why they have the fences, which is also, of course, to keep the union organizers out. And I wrote about this in No Logo quite a bit, so I won't dwell on it here. This is an image, I think quite a dramatic image, from a refugee camp in Hong Kong. And these are children, and many children are being born inside these camps and raised inside the camps. This is one of the most famous fences in North America, which is the fence, one of the many fences at the U.S.-Mexican border, also known as La Frontera. And since NAFTA was signed in 1994, this border has become increasingly militarized and dangerous because people are always trying to sneak across and run across or jump across, climb across. And here, actually, these are crosses that are put up to commemorate people who have died trying to cross the U.S.-Mexican border. And I think I'd be remiss in talking about fences without talking about the new security fence that's rising in northern Israel and many parts of Israel, separating Israeli villages from Palestinian-occupied villages. From Israeli-occupied Palestinian villages. So this is a shot from the construction, and this is a patrol shot. This is a shot from when Canada hosted the Summit of the Americas, which was held in Quebec City in April 2001. This was a meeting to advance the creation of the largest free trade zone in the world, which would, it's basically an enlargement of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, to include all of Latin America and the Caribbean. There was so much dissent about this meeting that they had to build a kind of a fortress, a fenced-in area. They caged the downtown. It wasn't a fence around the conference center, it was a fence around the whole city, and the people who live in Quebec had to carry documentation just to get home and to work. This is, the last G8 summit was held, this was a response to the protests in Genoa. They decided to hold it in the Canadian Rockies, in a place called Kananaskis. It's a ski resort, very remote, but yet they still put up some fences. This is the World Summit on Sustainable Development, which was just held in Johannesburg. Now, South Africa is already a very Johannesburg is already a very militarized city. But I have a friend from South Africa. I showed her these slides. She said that's just what it's like all the time there. But that's not quite true. They had a mega search park. They had spy planes, remote spy planes patrolling the skies, and huge amounts of barbed wire, which you see here in the police lines. There's really no incidents, but this is what they did to protect themselves, to have a summit on poverty. So the ironies were pretty intense, the lengths that they felt they had to go to protect themselves from poor people. This is actually, the fence became such a symbol in Quebec City. It was nicknamed the Wall of Shame, and this is, it actually came down. This is the fence coming down in Quebec City during the Summit of the Americas. This is Woomera, the Woomera Detention Center in Australia, the Australian outback, the South Australian desert. That fence also came down in a protest recently. The Woomera Detention Center is maybe the best symbol of the lie of globalization, the lie that this really is about freedom. It's a kind of a concentration camp in the middle of the desert. I visited last summer, and it's 500 kilometers from the nearest city, from Adelaide, and it used to be a military base. And the South Australian desert is a beautiful and terrifying place, with an absolutely devastating history. Because the myth about the South Australian desert is that there was no one there. That's what people always say. It's in the middle of nowhere. No one's there. And this idea. Underpinned the way that Australia was colonized. And in fact, Aboriginal people in Australia weren't even classified as human. They had the same classification as flora and fauna. So the idea was that it was terra nullius, nobody was there, to devastating genocidal results. And when they decided to test nuclear weapons there, they also told themselves that no one was there, but of course there were people there. And the health effects are still being felt today. The same idea that you can hide away the ugly side of globalization or these economic policies. You see at the Woomera Detention Center, which is actually a former military base, and it's now run by a privatized security company, which is a subsidiary of Wackenpack, which is the U.S. security company. This is also at the Woomera fence. This is one of the actions of the Woomera Detention Center. This is in South Africa. This person who is reconnecting electricity behind the electricity box behind the fence. In South Africa, 40,000 people lose access to electricity every month in the townships because electricity is being ready to be privatized, Eskom, the national electricity company. And so the rates are going up very quickly. And there's also been 40,000 layoffs at ESCOM, the National Energy Committee. So a group has been formed called the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee. And what the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee has done is they have paired these unemployed electricians with the people who are getting their electricity cut off, and they reconnect people's electricity for free. They call it power to the people. So that's the shot. And this is a Sebastian Salgado shot, so it's stunning, of the MST, the Landless People's Movement in Brazil. And they are occupying unused farmland, which is what the MST does. And they cut down fences or cut wires, which I'll come back to. End of snapshots. So here we are, 13 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And we are, in my opinion, surrounded by fences again, and walls, and police lines, and barbed wire, and prison bars. And those who are fortunate enough to be on the right side of those fences feel protected sometimes, or we used to, feel free to sail across borders with ease. And people who are on the outside, on the wrong side of those fences, are often obscured from our view, trapped in a maze of barriers and barricades, and desperate for the world to see them. And the Wamra Detention Center, the detainees, many of them from Afghanistan and Iraq, are so desperate for the world to see them, to see their fight, that they have taken incredibly desperate measures, as I'm sure you know, like sewing their mouths shut and drinking shampoo and jumping off buildings. So I'm going to be talking about fences as a way to understand the global order in which we find ourselves, an order that is both economic, social, and military. And I think that they're a helpful way to help us understand the connections between economic inequality and war, a subject which I'm not going to be talking about tonight in this lecture, but which I know is on many of our minds. And I'm also going to be talking a little bit about ways in which, as we saw in those photographs, people are trying to take fences down, because that's what all liberation struggle do. They take down fences between races, between genders, between classes, castes, and nations. But the task of taking down fences for us, if we're so inclined, is difficult these days. And it's difficult because the fences that we're up against aren't as obvious as fences of the past. It's not a wall separating a city. Our fences are the kind that deny that they exist even while you're banging your head up against them. But I think that it is possible, it's not impossible, to see these fences if we try. And it is easier to think about how we might confront them if we can understand them. So I'm going to separate it into four different categories, four different kinds of fences, and talk a little bit about how they're connected to each other. Now, the first kind of fence I'm going to talk about are the fences that are actually very difficult to see, that enclose our shared resources that human beings need to survive. Fences, for instance, that keep water and electricity, as I was just saying, from people who need them. Water from the thirsty, land from the landless, homes from the homeless, drugs from the dying, and power from the powerless. Now, these types of fences go by many names and euphemisms. Sometimes they're called privatization, sometimes they're called public-private partnerships, sometimes they're called patent protection, sometimes they're called structural adjustment programs. But they exist nonetheless. And when I was in South Africa for the World Summit on Sustainable Development, we saw how tangible they actually were with the cutoffs, these abstract numbers, 40,000 people a month losing access to electricity, what that actually means, particularly around water, because it's in the South African Constitution that every person has a right to water. But they've been finding all kinds of ways to get around that constitutional right. And people have to turn, when water is fenced off from them, they have to turn to contaminated sources, which usually means cholera-infested rivers, and there have been cholera outbreaks recently in South Africa. So there are fences that go along with the logic of privatization that keep these basic necessities out of reach of people who need them. And there's nothing more needed more desperately than water. And I was at a community meeting in a neighborhood called Chatsworth, which is part of Durban, in August. And they were talking about the World Summit on Sustainable Development. And they were also talking about the fact that, that their water was getting cut off. It was getting cut off because people were having what are called tricklers installed in their pipes. And what they are little tiny washers that take the flow of water, and they take it from turning it into a normal flow that you would get out of your tap. And it is forced to go through two tiny pinholes. And so it turns it into a trickle. So what people were having to do is wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to start the trickle so that there would be enough water to wash their face before they went to school at 6 or 7. And it was interesting that these things are called tricklers, because I thought it was an amazing metaphor for trickle-down economics. Because it rather than trickling down, it was turning actually a fairly healthy flow of water into this sort of demeaning trickle. So they were talking about what to do about these tricklers. And a lot of them were just starting to, you know, use Allen keys to take them out, and they were organizing to try to keep the people from coming into their neighborhoods to install them, because they felt it was a violation of their constitutional rights. And this woman stood up in this community meeting, and she said, there are people out there who seem to have a very strange idea. They think that water is like diamonds and gold. You know, this is a very powerful thing to say of South Africa, which is an economy that was built on diamond and gold money under apartheid and colonialism. And she said they think water is like diamonds, and they don't realize that water isn't like a diamond. It's a human right. You need water in life. You need water to live. So this is part of the fencing in of the commons, and there are fences that go up. For instance, around a school in Zambia, when an education user fee is introduced on the strong advice of the World Bank, which puts classes out of reach of millions of people. So these are the types of fences, invisible fences, which I think should make us skeptical whenever we hear that free trade in goods and services should be blindly equated with freedom itself. Because the current stage of globalization isn't simply about trade in the traditional sense of selling more products across services, across borders. What it is about, particularly with the world market in recession, is about feeding the insatiable need for growth and expansion, which is being frustrated in many ways, by redefining entire sectors, entire regions, entire parts of the planet, that weren't previously considered products or commodities, that were considered human rights, that were considered part of the commons as products, as commodities. Now this logic has reached into every aspect of our lives, whether health and education, or genes, seeds, ideas, patented and fenced off, as well as traditional remedies, plants, of course water, and even human stem cells, the privatization of life itself. And we shouldn't really be surprised by this, because the U.S.'s single largest export isn't manufactured goods. It's patents. It's copyright, trademarks on everything from music to drugs. So the role of international trade law, despite the rhetoric of taking barriers down and building bridges, is more accurately understood, I think, as a process of systematically putting up and enforcing new barriers around knowledge, technology, newly privatized resources through patent and trademark law, through privatization of services. These are the virtual fences that, even if you can't see them, have a very real effect, that tell farmers, for instance, that they can't save and replant seeds. They have to buy them every year from Monsanto. that tell artists that they can't cut and paste images of popular culture because they are trademarked for longer and longer periods of time. There's a very important lawsuit going on in the U.S. that is being driven by Disney to try to get their patents extended. That tell countries where millions are dying of AIDS that they can't copy a drug and distribute it and save lives. But these are fences, even if we can't see them. And the second kind of fence is related. And this is a fence, it's also a virtual fence, that surrounds democracy, that surrounds our ability to change things, to make other decisions, that restricts the ability of people to enact economic policies that provide alternatives to privatizations, alternatives to the policies geared towards the demands of foreign investors. Now this process of fencing in democracy, of restricting the parameters of democracy, is often associated with debt and often enforced by the World Bank or the IMF. And it's a familiar story which says you can have a loan as long as you follow a set of World Bank and IMF policies. The IMF was, there's a recently, I think, a very telling incident, because it's become quite fashionable now to say that countries, poor countries, developing countries, really need to spend much, much more on education. And even Jeffrey Sachs has said that poor countries should not pay their debt and should simply spend the money on health to deal with the desperate AIDS crisis in so many parts of the world. And he feels that if countries were to do that, were to not pay their debt and spend the money on health, that they would have a legitimate position to defend, and it would be very difficult to force them to pay it. But yet we saw an incident recently which showed that this is in fact not at all the case, because Ecuador, who's getting a loan from the International Monetary Fund to build a pipeline, and the government passed a law saying that they would dedicate 10% of any future proceeds from the pipeline to education and health. The rest of it would go to debt repayment. And when the International Monetary Fund realized that they had passed this law, they pulled the loan, and they said that they wouldn't get the loan until they rescinded the law, that they did not have the right to tie the future earnings to make sure that a majority of the population benefited from the resources that were being extracted. And Brazil, when they bucked global trends and produced generic AIDS drugs and distributed them free, found that they were able to cut the mortality rate from AIDS in half, but they were also dragged in front of the World Trade Organization and had their action challenged. Now, we're actually seeing a really dramatic process of what I'm talking about when I say the fencing in of democracy, the limiting not of people's ability to vote, who can still vote, but what governments can do once they're in power. We're seeing this right now unfold before our eyes in Brazil with the contested election there, and with Lula da Silva from the Workers' Party, from the PT, looking like he's going to win those elections. Now, when it became, in 1973, Henry Kissinger made a very famous statement about Chile and their decision to elect Salvador Allende. He said, and it's been quoted by many people, that a country shouldn't be allowed to go Marxist just because the people are irresponsible. And he said this to explain his support for Pinochet's coup. Now, we all laugh at that, but what, because it seems absurd that anyone would say that. Now, if we think about what happened in Venezuela, I think it's pretty clear that that logic isn't dead, but if we look at a less dramatic manifestation of what's going on in Brazil, what we see is that when it became clear that the Brazilian people were tired of these policies that were enforced under Cardoso, and that they wanted a change, that they were turning left, that they were turning to a party that has historically said that they would either not pay or renegotiate the debt, that they would not sign the free trade area of the Americas. I heard Lula say this when I was in Brazil last year, to many, many cheers, that they would halt further privatizations in Brazil. When the markets saw that Brazilian people were siding with the PT, were turning to Lula da Silva. The Brazilian economy was pummeled. And it wasn't pummeled because they weren't paying their debts. It wasn't pummeled because their indicators were off. In fact, it was at a very, very strong point. It was pummeled purely because, and if you read the Financial Times and the Economist, they say that the real, the Brazilian currency, is at its lowest point ever. And business is fleeing the country because they are fearful of future instability under a Lula government. So this is sort of like the logic of war right now. That you create instability out of fear of future instability. This is like George Bush waging preemptive war to prevent war. Now, the most dramatic preemptive fencing in of democracy in Brazil right now is being done by the International Monetary Fund. Now, they loaned Brazil $30 million during the summer, but they postdated the check. 80% of the money very cleverly comes after the election, after whoever is elected, and they realize that it will probably be Lula. And the money is clearly contingent, and they've said this. They have the right to rescind the loan if Brazil strays from the current economic course. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that this fencing in of democracy is something that only poor countries have to worry about. It's certainly something that is very much on the minds of people in the country where I live, in Canada. Last year, I took part in a project which we called Globalization in Your Backyard. And the idea was that these debates about globalization were becoming increasingly abstract. And they seem to be just about fights between protesters and police at summits. And I think that people, you know, watching these street fights on television weren't seeing how it connected with their daily lives. So the idea for this series, and it was actually a television series, was to go to six communities that were being transformed by globalization in several ways, where they were either producing a commodity for sale on the global market, or they were having a global firm come in and privatize a basic resource like water, and talk to them about how these policies were playing out in their lives. So to take this abstract idea and sort of bring it down to earth. And so we had these town hall debates where hundreds of people who lived in these communities came out and they talked to their mayors and they talked to their local politicians. And what we found is that people are not against trade, they're not against investment, but what they want in every one of these cases is they want to control it. They want the power to use investment to build diverse and sustainable economies that work for them, create good jobs, good schools for their kids, that doesn't take the quest for one resource like oil and overly impact the ability of another sector of the population to do something else like fish. They want the ability to balance interests, to have a diverse, complicated economy. And as you know, all of you who study economics, that only diverse economies are the ones that are doing well right now. They also wanted to be prudent. They wanted to have the ability to try something, and then if it didn't work, change their mind. Like if they tried it and the promises didn't deliver, it wasn't working, they wanted to be able to stop and not be penalized. That seems reasonable in a democracy to be able to do that. But what came up again and again in these debates was that people's demands for how to control their relationship to the market, not a yes-no decision, but how to control it, was illegal. But many of their core demands were illegal under trade deals that our federal government had already signed under the North American Free Trade Agreement. For instance, companies can sue governments for lost revenues if citizens do change their mind and decide that a certain industry is too polluting, that prices are too high. If they kick them out, then they can get sued, and this is what has already started to happen. I'll talk a little bit more about that. So we have democracy. We have the ability to vote every 2 years, but when it comes to deciding how to manage our economy, how to solve problems creatively and in unique ways, we find again and again that our democracies are fenced in, enclosed by all these conditions and restrictions that are placed on them, and that our democracies around the world in rich and poor countries are asphyxiating for lack of power, because power is the oxygen of democracy. Now, because I'm here at the LSE, I have to say this, that I know that many people believe that there's nothing wrong with fences, that fences are important, the basis of private property, that good fences make good neighbors, and all of that. So I think it's important that even given that, even if you believe that fences are needed to protect private property, to protect wealth, it's worth looking at some of the recent developments in the global economy, at whose fences are being protected and whose fences are not being protected. Now, the U.S. employees of Enron, for instance, found that their private property, i.e. their life savings in their pension funds, was not being protected when their company started to tank and go bankrupt. And they found out that their privatized retirement savings had locked them out. They couldn't sell. They couldn't get access to their pension funds. At the same time, as the executives at Enron were madly selling and unloading their stocks. So not everybody's private property, not everybody's fences are protected with equal enthusiasm. And I thought of this when I went to Argentina to study the economic crisis there. Because the citizens who deposited their life savings in Citibank's and HSBC banks also thought that that money would be safe and that they would be able to access it whenever they wanted to. They believed in the market. They believed in capitalism. Now only 50% of Argentine citizens believe in capitalism, and you can hardly blame them. Because in December of last year, they found that they no longer had access to their bank accounts. And we talked to people, and they said, you know, I thought if it was in a Citibank, if it was in an HSBC bank, you know, they can't just change the rules like that, but they did. And they watched their money disappear. The banks themselves, meanwhile, pulled their money out of Argentina. And when the government went after the banks that had pulled their money out illegally, they went after them under a law in Argentina that prohibits economic subversion. And it's interesting because the International Monetary Fund, you know, they always say that they want a transparent rules-based system and they want to eliminate political corruption. But one of the conditions that they placed on Argentina receiving another loan was that they had to eliminate this law, the economic subversion law, which they were using to go after the bankers. So that's a sort of underreported story. But I think it's interesting because the law that the government implemented that prevented access to bank accounts in Argentina is called El Corralito, which means the little fence. Now the third kind of fence I want to talk about is also one of these ephemeral fences. The best way I would describe it is the fences of social exclusion. These are the fences that keep people out, that decree that certain people are not necessary in the production of wealth. Now, what I mean by social exclusion is the idea that people are no longer needed in the production of wealth. Their way of life is obsolete. Now, there's many ways that you might experience this. Maybe you live in the Narmada Valley in India, and your village has been submerged by a massive dam, which is happening right now. Or maybe you're a small farmer, and you can no longer compete with factory farms that have remade agriculture. Or maybe you work for a public company that is being privatized and downsized. These economic policies have bred armies of locked out people who are told that their services are no longer needed, that their lifestyles are obsolete. And in Argentina, this happened en masse in the mid-1990s. The crisis that we actually think of as having started last year actually started several years ago, when unemployment started to rise. In Argentina, they call the people whose communities have been wiped out. They economically disappeared, which is, I think, it's a very powerful phrase to use in a country where during the dictatorship between 1976 and 1983, 30,000 people were disappeared. That was the phrase that was used because the military dictatorship, the generals, they didn't do what Pinochet did in Chile. They didn't just massacre people. They were kidnapped from their homes one by one, and then when their parents went to the police station to try to find them, they said that they had no record of them, they had no idea where they were, they were just vanished, they were disappeared. And to this day, many of them have, and the families have never been given confirmation that their children are dead. So this phrase, disappeared, is now being used to describe people who are being economically wiped out. And they also say in Argentina that their whole country is being disappeared. Now this process of disappearing people is dangerous. It's dangerous not just for the people who are being disappeared, but for the people who are not being disappeared, because it breeds a kind of nihilistic violence that is the hallmark both of the urban gangster and the fanatical terrorist. A culture that is willing to live side by side with the walking disappeared, the invisible, is also a culture that has agreed to live with a kind of blinding rage at invisibility. And that is the twisted revenge seeker of the school shooter, the sniper, perhaps even the suicide bomber. That the people who settle in their last moments of life simply for being seen. Now the truth is that people who turn to violence are a tiny minority, and that the vast majority of the global economy's fenced out people don't turn to violence. What they do is they just move. They move around from countryside to city, from city to city, from country to country. And it's when they do this that they start to encounter the fourth kind of fence, the fence that we saw in those slides. The fences around the factories, around the refugee detention centers at our borders. Because, of course, the fence that came down between France and Germany didn't disappear into thin air, it just moved. It moved to the perimeter of Fortress Europe. And these fences are not at all virtual. They are very real, made of chain link and razor wire, reinforced with concrete, guarded with machine guns. And all of these fences, all of these four different kinds of fences, are connected to each other in some way. Because these real fences at the border, around the refugee camps, around the prisons, are needed to enforce the virtual ones, the ones that put so many of our shared resources, so much of our shared wealth, planetary wealth, so much power and decision-making out of the hands of so many. It simply isn't possible to lock away this much of our collective wealth and so many people's right to self-determination without an accompanying strategy to contain popular unrest and contain mobility. Now, in the United States, the richest country in the world, the number of people who are inside the corrections system hit a record high last year after a record boom. 6.6 million people, more than the population of Denmark, in the United States are behind bars or on probation. And we also know that security firms do their biggest business in the cities and countries where the gap between rich and poor is widest, like in Johannesburg, like my friend said. It looks like that all the time. Johannesburg is actually a city of walls. In the rich areas. If you drive around Sandton, which is the richest neighborhood in Johannesburg, you actually don't see the palatial houses, which are there, but they're all behind these very high walls, which are guarded with alarm systems. And now if something happens, you know, if you're a regular person and you were carjacked or raped in Johannesburg, which happens sadly all the time, you will wait hours if you call the police. But if an alarm goes off in one of these private security systems, when we saw this happen once, the police are there within 2 minutes. It's the most remarkable thing, you have an armed guard there. And annual spending on private security in South Africa reached $1.6 billion last year, which is more than three times what the government spends each year on affordable housing. Now it seems that these gated compounds, which protect the haves from the have-nots, seems to me that they're kind of microcosms of what is fast becoming not a global village as we were promised in 1989, but a global security state, which allows goods and services to flow across borders, which allows stocks to be traded and currencies to be traded, but keeps people out. So what we have is less the global village than a network of fortresses connected by highly militarized trade corridors. Now many of us here, and this is the reason I'm dwelling on these fences in a place like this, is that I think it's really easy to go about our daily lives and really forget that they exist, even though we can read about a place like Guamra in a newspaper, or hear about what's going on in the U.S.-Mexican border, or hear those numbers about the U.S. prison population. But it's really easy to go about your daily life and not see a trace of it. And I think that that's why, if we look to the kinds of social movements that are emerging around the world, one of the most powerful recurring themes is the idea of rematerializing people. People who have been disappeared by these economic policies. Now, I think the best example of what I mean by a reappearance act, was staged by the Zapatistas in Chiapas, Mexico in 1994. They began their uprising the day that NAFTA became law on January 1st, 1994. And they called their rebellion, they gave it a very interesting name, they called it a war against oblivion. And they said that they had become invisible, and that they were about to be displaced by energy projects, by massive energy projects in Chiapas, and also by industrial agriculture, which was displacing the Mayan way of life. So they were about to join those millions of rootless people wandering the globe looking for a place. And the symbol of their uprising on January 1st, as I'm sure you all know, is the symbol of the masked man, Marcos, and the other Zapatistas wearing these sort of ski masks. And masks are interesting because, in a sense, a mask is kind of a personal fence, a personal barrier protecting your face from the world, from seeing you. But the Zapatistas, in their writings, said that this was actually wrong. That they, when they put on masks, they weren't hiding. What they said was that before they put on masks, they were invisible. Nobody could see their faces. But when they put on masks and began their uprising, they were seen by the world. They could no longer ignore them. And so they said the Zapatista is the face that hides itself to be seen. Now many more ways are being found to dramatize invisibility, to rematerialize, erase people, and to confront these fences. And we've seen this at summits with confrontation staged at summit fences. We've seen it at WAMRA with these attempts to out these detention centers with the actions that I showed you slides of earlier. In my city, there's quite a serious homelessness crisis going on, where a couple of winters ago, 22 people died on the streets, a very cold city. And there's a radical anti-poverty group in the city where I live called OCAP, and they have been thinking about ways to bring the issue of homelessness into the public sphere, and because it's also something that's very easy to ignore because it's being criminalized, because it's being made illegal to squeegee windows and to panhandle it. So they've been trying all kinds of tactics. But part of what they're doing is they're occupying abandoned buildings and insisting that they be turned into affordable housing. They did this very recently when the Pope came to visit. The Pope came to visit during Catholic World Youth Day. And the city was awash in talk of peace and love and charity. So they thought, well, this is a good time to insist on our right to a roof over our heads. So they occupied a rather large building, and they named it the Pope Squad. There have been many, many examples of this, of rematerialization. The other thing that they did is they symbolically evicted the Minister of Housing, which I thought was an interesting reappearance act. They just moved his filing cabinets into the streets. Through this process, we have seen many sectors of economically disappeared people reappear, becoming communities instead of simply consumers, farmers instead of the land's poor, neighbors instead of faceless strangers. Now, as I said earlier in my next lecture, I'm going to be talking about ways that these movements are attempting to protect these spaces by experimenting with new forms of decentralized power and participatory democracy. What's exciting to me about this decentralized model of social change is that I believe, even though it's slow and less dramatic, that it is fundamentally anti-fundamentalist, because it doesn't seek to impose a system from on high, but creates the mechanisms for many diverse and subtle systems to emerge from below. And that is indeed its goal, as Zapatistas call a world with the possibility of many worlds in it. But I do believe that despite all of these fences and all of this bad news I've been giving you, that there is reason for optimism, particularly in all of this resistance. And we see it in everything from people sharing music and software on the internet to resisting the privatization of water and electricity. Because I think that it shows that despite all of these elaborate attempts to enclose the commons and to restrict our ability to change things and even to fence in our imagination, that it turns out that there are some things that don't want to be owned. Music, water, electricity, people, ideas. They keep bursting out of the confines that we put around them. They have a natural resistance to enclosure, a tendency to escape, to cross-pollinate, to flow through fences, and flee out open windows. Thank you.
What do you think are going to be the challenges of the new coming Brazilian government?
Candidate and paper economic orthodoxy, I'm very student. Have you been supported by your fellow Canadian, John Tennis Galbraith, who I'm glad to say still with us, so I'd be interested in that. In Canadian economic orthodoxy, have you been influenced by your fellow Canadian born professor, John Tennis Galbraith, whose writings I personally enjoy?
I'm wondering who the commons are. You made reference them twice.
I was wondering how you really define globalization. You said that the fellow from the Wall Street Journal defined it as freedom. Would you define it as fencing?
Would you say that there might be a fence around capital itself that limited liability?
Yes,
constitutes offence, that you get value flowing to shareholders from other stakeholders, but not the other way.
Okay,
I'm going to try to answer all these. I'm not sure I can answer the last one. The challenges for the new Brazilian government will be vast, for the reasons I explained, because they will not be able to make good on their promises without losing the IMF's loan. If they lose the IMF's loan and the country falls deeper into economic crisis, they of course will be blamed. There's an interesting precedent, however, which is that this same party, Lula's party, the PT, came to power in the city of Porto Alegre in 1989. And when they came to power in 1989, I interviewed the first mayor of Porto Alegre, a guy named Raul Pont. And I asked him about what happened when they came to power. And he said, you know, it was 1989. The idea of a socialist government was, you know, kind of absurd. Socialism was failing around the world. We didn't have a strong mandate. We had a huge amount of pressure. So what we decided to do to gain legitimacy and to make ourselves for more radical redistributive policies is we created all kinds of mechanisms for participation. They introduced something called the participatory budget. And I think that the only hope that Lula has if and when he wins is if he, rather than trying to be a Hugo Chavez and just ramming through the policies, you know, what come what may, if he hides behind the people of Brazil who actually want these policies and creates all kinds of mechanisms for direct democracy, like referenda on membership in the FTAA. And so then when the IMF comes after them, they're going to have to know, they won't be able to just go after government. They'll have to be openly defying the democratic will of the Brazilian people. Have I been influenced by John Kenneth Galbraith or JKG, as we call him? I think definitely. And I think really what I'm talking about here tonight is really what he spent his whole life working on, which is trying to get economists to stop equating economic growth with well-being and prosperity. I had the opportunity to meet him a couple of years ago, and I tried to influence him a little bit because he at the time that I met him, he was getting all of his information from the New York Times, and he felt about the protests in Seattle. It was right after Seattle, and he said that he thought that the protesters were rejecting internationalism, and he said, I'm a lifelong internationalist, and I can't accept this. So I told him to stop reading Thomas Friedman, and that the protesters are the true internationalists, and he should be happy, because people are finally listening to him. And I was also asked to define globalization, which I think flows from that answer, which is that I think globalization is a useless phrase, to be honest. It is used to bundle a whole bunch of very different ideas, like internationalism, tourism, migration, and trade. And the idea, I think, it's a deliberate strategy, so that if you're against one part of it, i.e. the economic policies that I've been discussing, then you're a protectionist, you're a localist, you're against travel, you're against the internet. So I think it's really important to try to unpack these so that we can embrace internationalism and be critical about policies that are very deliberate. I think it's an attempt to try to make deliberate human-made policies seem like kind of acts of gravity and nature, to have an air of inevitability so that, you know, resistance is futile. So I hope that answered that question. I was asked, who are the commons? What are the commons? Well, that's a really tough question. But I think that there's all kinds of legal precedent in, you know, in international law where we define what our human rights are. We say that every human being has the right, declared in countless UN charters, to food, water, shelter, freedom, movement, and we have been told that these can be administered by the market. I think that what we're seeing is that it's failing. So when I talk about protecting the commons, I'm talking about protecting what is needed by humans to survive. And I think that a lot of the debates are really focused on that. When we talk about AIDS drugs, when we talk about water, shelter, land. And I I did the best I could.
Truly, five more. At the back.
What measures would help the Argentine economy?
I'd like to ask another question about how movements such as the Zapatistas, in NST in Brazil and in South Africa, address the question of state power, basically, because it seems to me, in the minute of what we live in, it's very obvious that the state is being used, on behalf of the capitalist class to repress these movements, whether it's demonstrated to be shot in Argentina against the IMF, whether it's in encirclement of the Zapatistas, almost where the use of their police presence at summits, almost greater than in the current war on terrorism, the state is being used in a very political way, and I'd like to ask a question about how movements such as the Zapatistas should address this question of power and credit.
Do you think the expansion of the European Union is going to make more fences, or is it going to just make fences down?
Sorry, yeah, you're talking to a really influential group of young people here who will potentially be. What would you say to the people who go through schools like LSE and want to make a difference in the world? Where can they start? Where can they head? And what can they do?
Yeah, I just rushed over from old theatres. I have a question that hasn't been asked before. You were talking about people who were locked out by privatisation because their services were no longer needed because they were laid off. I was just wondering, because as a matter of fact, some of those state-owned companies were very inefficient and they made a lot of loss and were actually tapping into tax money from everybody, from the general public. So what would actually the solution be? Obviously, yes, it's bad to lay those people off. But if they keep working for an inefficient company, I don't know what's your stance. And maybe also, wouldn't you say that the heart of the problem is that people are essentially selfish and they're also always out for their own good? And if they have a choice, they will always protect their own and not someone else. And that's why capitalism just feeds into that
about self-determination, democracy, and I think that, in fact, the debate about globalization is a debate about self-determination, and which is what I've been trying to draw connections between democracy in general and the way that's restricted, and what people need in order to make democracy more than a ritual. What do you need to take freedom and turn it into real opportunity? So that it isn't just a hollow victory. And this theme of self-determination recurs again and again in my research and in my work. And I do think that there is a connection, though it isn't a sort of parallel exact connection. But I don't think that there ever are parallel exact connections. I think every situation is unique. And the idea of sort of taking the Middle East out of the world and saying it's so unique, it's so specific, it's so complicated that it doesn't belong in any other of geopolitical or economic context, which I think we sometimes tend to do, is dangerous. I think that there are all kinds of issues around access to water, for instance, just around people's need and right to mobility and their right to self-determination. So when we talk about access and resources, I think we have to make those connections to the world. These are very good questions. What measures will help Argentina? One of the things that's really interesting about Argentina, and I'm going to be talking about this a lot in my next lecture, is that you know, I could sit here and I could say, okay, well, you know, reverse the privatizations, nationalize the banks, you know, whatever sort of formula, recipe. Some of it might be a good idea, some of it would be a really bad idea. What's going on in Argentina, and I'm not going to go into this in depth because it's too big, is that there is a really profound rejection of the idea that anybody can come up with a plan for this country that has been so mismanaged, and that what they need to do is create mechanisms for people to decide, and that the mechanisms that they're talking about are things like constituent assemblies. There's been an explosion of neighborhood-based organizing in Argentina since the government fell. You know, they went through 5 presidents in 2 weeks. And then they looked at each other and were like, well, you know, what are we going to do? Now what? What do you do when you've overthrown 5 governments in 2 weeks? And so they started to meet in their neighborhoods, and they started to organize, to meet basic needs for food, for housing. But they also started to talk about how they could translate these ideas around direct democracy into a new way of governing that could solve the problem of how they got into this mess in the first place. This massive political corruption and economic corruption. And you know, Argentina has an incredibly profound authoritarian history. You know, there's a terrible history among one sector of the population for always believing that the military can come in and save them. You know, the coup in 76 was welcomed by a majority of the Argentinian population because they wanted order. On the other side, you have another tradition of always looking to authoritarian heroes like Juan Perón, Evita, even Che came from Buenos Aires. And now there is an idea that maybe the only real sustainable solutions will come from systematically decentralizing power and not believing in saviors anymore. So I know this is an economic recipe for you, but I think maybe that might even be part of the solution, that there is no economic recipe, and that anybody who steps forward and says, we have the answer, we have the solution, gets shouted down by the people, whether they come from a left-wing party or a right-wing party right now. So there's an idea, there's a politician in Argentina called Luis Zamora, who's quite high up in the polls. He's a national deputy. And his idea is that in the next elections, which are at the end of March, they should not run candidates, but they should run ideas for how to change the constitution to make it more democratic. Well, like I said, this is the subject of my next speech. There was a question about MST and state power. I guess all I can say to that is that what I'm seeing is that what's most interesting about these social movements, like the MST, like the Zapatistas, like in Argentina, the Picoteros and the neighborhood assemblies, is that they don't see power the way traditional left groups saw power. And they're rejecting the narrative of going after the center and just getting your guy into office, your party into office. Everything will be fine with Fidel Castro or Hugo Chavez. The idea is to figure out rules and mechanisms to decentralize power and to give communities more leeway and power. And you saw this with the Zapatistas when they went to Mexico City to demand the indigenous Bill of Rights. What they were asking for was more cultural and political autonomy. So I can't get into this much more deeply. I was asked about the expansion of the European Union. Is that taking fences down or more fences up? I have cough drops. All right. This is happening in North America right now with the idea of creating Fortress NAFTA. I have tons of them because I keep having coffee sips. All right. Here, you can. I'm not an expert on Europe, but I think what's happening, and we saw a glimpse of it this summer in Spain, where there was a group of migrant workers from Africa that had from North Africa that had always picked fruit in southern Spain in the summer. And they came to pick fruit this summer, and they got there, and they were told that there was a new rule that they would no longer, they could no longer hire North Africans, that they had to hire people from Europe. I think that there will be fences taken down and new fences gone up, because there's a certain amount of cheap labor that Europe needs and that North America needs. And that basically, my prediction is that Europe will be enlarged. There will be a pool of cheap labor from Eastern Europe within Fortress Europe, and it will not need to let in people from Africa or Asia or the Arab world. The same strategy is at work now in North America, where you're seeing negotiations between Vincente Fox and George Bush about the creation of a security perimeter around NAFTA. So it would be, the idea would be to include NAFTA in the North American security perimeter. The US and Canada would have their supply of fruit pickers and janitors, and they can lock down. Now, David is telling you we need to finish, but I haven't dealt with the fact that humans are fundamentally selfish. And what can LSE students do? And I guess the answer is that you just gotta stop being selfish.
For the rest of you, this discussion will continue on the 22nd of October. So once again, thanks very much.